Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with film producer Chris Palmer, who's also author of the book Shooting in the Wild, an insider's account of making movies in the animal kingdom, recently published by Sierra Club Books. We'll talk about his experiences in wildlife filmmaking, its conservation impact, and also the dark side of the business that many filmmakers would prefer remains hidden. Chris Palmer is an environmental and wildlife film producer who has swum with dolphins and whales, confronted sharks, come face to face with Kodiak bears, camped with wolf packs, and waded hip deep through an Everglades swamp. He has spent 25 years leading the production of more than 300 hours of original programming for primetime television and the IMAX film industry. He has worked with many celebrities in his films, including Robert Redford, Paul Newman, Jane Fonda, Ted Turner, and Ted Danson. And his films have been broadcast on the Disney Channel, TBS Superstation, Animal Planet, in global IMAX theaters, among others. You may already be familiar with some of his many IMAX films, such as Whales, Wolves, Dolphins, Bears, India, Kingdom of the Tiger, Coral Reef Adventure, and Grand Canyon Adventure. In 2004, Chris joined the full-time faculty at American University as Distinguished Film Producer in Residence, and he also founded the Center for Environmental Filmmaking at the School of Communication, which he now directs. However, he continues to produce films, give keynote speeches, and conduct workshops across the country. Chris and his colleagues have won numerous awards, including two Emmys and an Oscar nomination. In 2009, Chris received the Lifetime Achievement Award for Media at the International Wildlife Film Festival, and he recently received the Environmental Film Educator of the Decade Award at the Green Globe Film Awards in Los Angeles. A common theme running through Chris Palmer's career is his belief that environmental and wildlife films and new media are powerful and important tools in the struggle to protect the environment. In part, that's why he wrote his book, Shooting in the Wild, an insider's account of making movies in the animal kingdom, and started a campaign among filmmakers for greater transparency. Profiles about Chris and his book have appeared in many different media outlets, including the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post, and he's also appeared on Nightline, The Today Show, the Fox News Channel, and other networks. Perhaps that's because his book Shooting in the Wild has generated a lot of controversy, largely because in it, Chris reveals a pervasive and troubling trend toward audience deception, sensationalism, extreme risk-taking, and even abuse in wildlife films. Wildlife filmmakers typically present their animal subjects as wholly natural. Yet Chris reveals that human interventions are everywhere, even in his own films. From manufacturing sounds, like opening and closing an umbrella to simulate the beating of an eagle's wings, to staging fights between predators and prey, to filming captive animals such as bears or wolves and passing them off as wild, to using settings that aren't entirely natural, Chris Palmer shows how audiences are regularly deceived. Did you know that the famous shots of lemmings hurling themselves over a cliff in the 1958 Disney documentary White Wilderness was faked, and that it was actually members of the crew who threw the animals to their doom? Or that the main polar bear character in the 2007 National Geographic film Arctic Tale, which depicted several years in the life of a polar bear and her cubs, was actually a composite of several animals? Or that, after his team failed to get footage for the IMAX movie Wolves, Palmer himself employed captive wolves from a Montana game farm on a manufactured set in order to shoot the scene of a mother wolf suckling her pups. In the following interview, we talk about the motivations for this type of trickery and why these deceptions can be both helpful and problematic. We also discuss the implications of intrusive on-camera hosts like Steve Irwin and Bear Grylls, as well as what the sensationalized fangs and claws type shows like Man vs. Wild mean for wildlife conservation. For instance, in the drive to get ratings, the demonization of certain species, like sharks, where they're constantly depicted as murderous and evil, can ultimately reduce support for their protection. Finally, we'll talk about what both filmmakers and audiences can do to encourage transparency in filmmaking and potentially enhance its conservation impact. Palmer recommends a variety of steps, For filmmakers, he suggests full disclosure in pre-production, working with reputable scientists, integrating the film into broader campaigns, and improving ethical training of filmmakers. He also recommends that audiences be more skeptical, to question suspect shots, and to write to networks to demand clarity about how these films were made. He also says social media can be used to raise questions, build communities around this issue, and to promote responsible films among friends and colleagues. I spoke to Chris Palmer a couple of weeks ago, along with my intern for the wildlife, Benjamin Kennedy, a student in the professional writing program at Vermont Champlain College. We started by asking Chris how he first got involved in wildlife filmmaking.
A lot of the publicity around your book, Shooting in the Wild, has focused on the deception in filmmaking, and we're definitely going to talk about that a little later, but I wanted to start by talking about your career and filmmaking more generally, and I'd love for you to relate how you first got involved in filmmaking.
Well, first of all, Lark, may I just say how delightful it is to be on the, to do this interview with you. You yourself are a distinguished environmental journalist. I've been reading your book, Animal Investigators. It's fabulous. And I'm so pleased to be talking with you and Ben Kennedy. And the way I got started in this business was because I got frustrated as a lobbyist. I was a lobbyist for the National Audubon Society. And I went up to Capitol Hill and would lobby on for clean energies, renewables, reform of natural gas pricing, things like this, quite arcane subject. I was an energy policy wonk. And I began to question my effectiveness. I was in my young 30s, and I thought, what am I doing? Is this really the best use of my time? And I began to think maybe what I should do instead is try and find some way to influence the people who elect our legislators in the first place rather than simply try and influence them once they got there. And that led me to think about television, and I remember the story of Henry Winkler, how he mentioned on one of his shows, what was it called? ABC's Happy Days, I think it was called, how he was getting a library card, and I was amazed to find out that the next day, the country's libraries were swamped with young kids asking for a library card. In other words, I began to see the influence that television could have on people, and I began to think, oh my gosh, why didn't I produce television shows that could influence people and use celebrity power to do that? And so I began to think about that. About the same time, Ted Turner was beginning to look for new programming for his TBS superstation. We're talking now about 1982, something like that. And I ran into a colleague of his, Barbara Pyle, who told me he was looking. And I said to her, well, I've actually got an idea. And she liked the idea and took it to Ted. Ted liked it. And after some discussions, Ted and I formed a partnership between TBS and the National Audubon Society. That's what got me into environmental conservation television programming.
Now, is that background, it seems to me that background as someone working in conservation rather than a professional filmmaker is quite a bit different than a lot
exactly. of... Exactly. Yes, no, you're quite right. I mean, I never went to film school. I knew nothing about film making. I didn't know which end of a camera was which. I knew nothing about it. So when I got into this business in my young... when I was about 33 or something like that, I was on a very, very steep learning curve, and I hired a lot of people to help me, coach me, to teach me about the business, and I had to learn doing it. And so we started producing films. I hired editors, writers, cinematographers, and then, over the last 30 years, have gradually, learned the business, and partly my book, Shooting in the Wild, it's a part of it. It's kind of a memoir of that whole experience.
Because of your background in conservation, for you, what is really the job of wildlife films?
The job is to promote conservation. Now, that isn't as simple as it sounds, because a lot of people say, no, that is not the job. But that's what I would say. I come out of conservation. I was an environmentalist. In fact, when I changed from being a lobbyist to a TV producer, some people thought, like my parents thought, I changed jobs, but no, I hadn't at all. I just changed the tools I was using to achieve conservation. One was going up to the hill and lobby and testify as an expert witness, and then television was simply using television to influence the people who elected the people who I was trying to influence. So I hadn't changed jobs at all. But so I come at this from a different viewpoint than somebody, say, who goes to film school and has different, you know, maybe their goal is to entertain people in some way or something like that. But anyway, my goal has always been to use television to promote conservation, to not only build awareness of conservation, but to help people, bring people to action so they will actually change their behavior or help influence public policy. You ask a very good question, what is the purpose of wildlife films? And I would have to say that my purpose is to promote conservation, but have to quickly amend that by saying I'm not claiming that is the purpose that everybody else has when they make these films.
I know a lot of people, you mention in your book, Shooting in the Wild, a quote from David Suzuki that if you get people to appreciate nature, that they'll protect it. So some would argue that the job of the wildlife film is just simply by promoting nature appreciation, you end up getting a conservation action.
Yeah, good point. Good point. There's a lot of debate about this. In fact, I went through I changed my mind about this a couple of times, because when I first started, that's what I thought. I thought that if you simply, in fact, I thought there was a direct linkage between ratings and conservation. In other words, the higher the ratings, the higher the impact of conservation. I've come now to think that's a naive view, and that ratings is only just one metric, and maybe not a very good one, of the conservation impact. There obviously is a link between conservation and ratings, because if you get a rating, no one's watching, you can't achieve anything. But it's also true to say that if you get a high rating, it doesn't necessarily mean you've had a high conservation impact.
Can you give me an example?
For example, Blue Planet had a high rating but did not have a high conservation impact. So what was your question again, Laurel? Excuse me.
Oh, just about the difference between promoting conservation and promoting nature appreciation, and whether
yes.
one will do the other.
Yes. Thank you. That's such a good question. And
it's not an easy one to answer, I realize.
Not an easy, and there's a lot of debate about it. And I used to go to festivals and give speeches and say, listen, we are not having any impact. It's not enough to say raising people's awareness, because what does that mean? How do you measure it, and what does it mean? The only thing that matters is what you can really measure, which is, are people contributing more? Are people volunteering their time more? Are people voting differently? Are people putting pressure, you know, writing letters to congressmen to change policies? You know, I made the case that it's these actions that was real conservation, and this thing about raising awareness is basically BS. But you know, I've changed my mind about this, Laurel. I now think that which is obvious that there's a process that goes on, and obviously someone to become a conservation begins with awareness. So I think a program that simply raises awareness, maybe it's a film about wildebeest, or maybe it's like the new National Geographic film coming out on migration start. By the way, it's excellent. I've seen it, an excellent program starting I think November the 7th on National Geographic Channel. Great, it's called Great Migrations. Something like that, not a strong conservation message. In fact, hardly any conservation in there, but a very wonderful way of awakening people to the wonders of the natural world. And that is good. I used to be contemptuous of that. I mean, what, you know, that's just all BS. I think I was too quick to judge on that. Now I think about it, I think, you know, we're all in different stages. You know, some people are contemptuous of environmental conservation and want nothing to do with it, just think it's a left-wing plot. Other people on the other extreme think it's absolutely critical for our future. I'm in that category. But then there are people all the way along that spectrum, from indifference all the way to, you know. So
there's really a spectrum of perspectives, and we really need films for that whole range along the spectrum.
So we need a diversity of films, some which are just about the beauty of nature, others which are very hard-hitting, like An Inconvenient Truth. And so we need a variety. I've come to the conclusion, and I sort of tell this whole story, this evolution of my thinking in the book, that it is good to have a diversity of programming, and each one of us has different needs.
So in your own personal adventures, I know you've had quite a lot of interesting adventures, and I'm just curious, what has been sort of your most fun film to have made?
Well, I think many of them, but I think one of them is our first IMAX film we made on whales about in 1996. It came out. I made it with David Clark and Roger Payne, to terrific people.
Which I have to say, it's an amazing film. I saw it when
you.
It came out and just loved it.
Thank you. Well, it did very well. It cost about $3 to $4 million to make, but it grossed about $65 million, and is still being leased. So it's a very good film. And you asked me what was the most fun. And there, I mean, I think I remember that so well. First of all, it was
so
my
clearly,
first.
Clearly, yes. You don't get seasick.
Right. Yeah, no, well, a tiny bit, but, you know, even the best sailors like Lord Nelson got seasick, so I don't mind admitting to being seasick. But I think, you know, swimming with whales in Hawaii was just a wonderful experience, and seeing them, they're just magnificent animals. The blue whale, the largest animal that's ever lived. I mean, these are extraordinary animals, social animals. They have these strong family bonds. And very mother calf loving relationships and so on. So they're just extraordinary animals, totally fascinating. For us to be hurting them in any way, as you know, Iceland, Japan, and Norway still want to hunt them, and I think that's wrong and should be stopped. I think whales are, and dolphins too. These are, you know, intelligent, charismatic, social beings. It's just to me unacceptable that we would ever harm them in any way.
Now, you've been involved in some related things on whales, I know, and I'm curious about the conservation impact of that IMAX movie.
Well, it's hard to measure the impact of the conservation impact of that movie. That, you know, this is the problem with this is the challenge with discussing these films and conservation, because what is the link? How do you separate out the impact of that film from everything else that's going on? The work of nonprofits, an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal, another documentary on another network, you know, the lobbying going on Capitol Hill. So much else is going on. So when one asks the question, which is a good question to ask, you know, what is the conservation impact of that Wales IMAX film seen by all those millions of people? Hard to say. You know, it's hard to say in a scientific way. You know, one could talk generally, one could tell anecdotal, got this great letter from a mum who said how much her daughter loved it, now want to become a marine scientist. But, you know, these are just anecdotes and don't mean a lot. I mean, they're nice, but they don't mean a lot. And so measuring the impact of these films is very hard to do.
I know you add the question in your book, Shooting in the Wild, would some of this money spent on films be better spent on direct conservation?
Well, I think that's a question we have to ask. Yeah, I mean, would it be better, you know, if you're doing a film about black-footed ferrets, is that a good use of the money? Or would that $500,000 be better spent on contributed to a fund to preserve, to buy the land, to preserve the land from development? So those are good questions. I think we need to keep on asking them. I think probably the answer is that both are needed. All these things are needed. We need to lobby to buy land. We need to press hard on the media angle. We need all these things: communications, lobbying, education. We need everything. And probably that's going to be the solution. It's like waging a war. It's multifaceted. You can't neglect anything. But like with a war, you have trade-offs. You move your forces from this breach to this area, and you have to be skillful and adaptable. I think we have to be in the environmental movement. We have to be adaptable and skillful and nimble. And sometimes it might be best not to make a film and instead use that money for some other cause, education or something else. So I think we need to keep asking those questions. They're not easy to answer. It's not all black and white. There's a lot of exercise of good judgments, but we need to keep asking those types of questions.
You know, I was struck by your relationship with Ted Turner, and also the impact, as you relate in your book, that Ted Turner had on environmental filming. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that relationship.
Well, Ted Turner is an extraordinary guy. His most outstanding characteristic is his fearlessness. He's not afraid of anything. And the other thing about him that I like is he's very, in his business dealing, he's very, very honest. I was once in a meeting with him, negotiating a deal between Audubon and him. There were three of us in the room, Ted and me, and one of his vice presidents, a friend of mine, a good person called Jerry Hogan. And we were chatting, we were talking, and negotiating, and just, you know, working out a renewing the deal between Audubon and TBS, and we worked out, he and I just worked out the details of it, as he was wont to do, a very quick decision maker, and with broad strokes, we worked out the deal, and after about maybe half an hour or so, we shook hands on it, and Jerry Hogan and I left the office. We went down to Jerry's office to as it were, to paper the deal, to put it down in writing. So we were, and as we were, he and I were discussing it, we found we had a disagreement. Jerry said, and I forget what the substance of it was. I think it was to do maybe with the overseas rights. It doesn't really matter what it was. But Jerry said, you know, Chris, I think that, you know, this is what you and Ted agreed to. And I said, I don't think so, Jerry. What I heard him say was that. And we had a disagreement, so we couldn't resolve it. After a bit, Jerry said, well, let me go back and ask Ted. And I sat there thinking, well, this is ridiculous. I mean, that we're two of them together are obviously going to come back with a decision that that Jerry's interpretation was the correct one, because they're obviously very much financially in their favor to do so, and there are only three of us. So I was sitting there expecting to come back and say, sorry, Chris, Ted says that you were wrong on that, you know, that I'm right on that and you're wrong. So I was amazed when Jerry Hogan came back in the office and said, I talked to Ted, you're right. You know, in other words, you know, he was completely honest about it, and even though he could have easily gone the other way, in his own, it would have been his own self-interest, financial interest to do so. So I've greatly admired him for that, and he's been great to work with. We made films on all kinds of things. We made about 60, 70 films together on climate change, population, black-footed ferrets, cougars, Florida Everglades. I mean, just, you know, everything you could think of. They were all hosted by celebrities, people like Bob Redford and Ted Danson and famous people like this. Because we were trying, remembering back to that thing I mentioned about Henry Winkler, we were trying to tap into the celebrity thing. Which is quite common now, but back then in the 80s it wasn't so common. They were all about conservation. They weren't just about pretty pictures showing wildebeest migrating. They all had a conservation message. And we were very very proud of them. We promoted them hard. They got pretty good ratings, and I think they did a lot of good. But again, it's hard to measure their impact because so much else is going on. But we did do one or two shows where there was, you could really tell there was an impact. For example, we did one show called Rage Over Trees with Paul Newman. And this led directly to the saving of a beautiful watershed out in Oregon. So there are occasional times when you can see a direct link between a film and its impact, but that's kind of rare. So I hope I answered your question, Laurel, about Ted and about the films we did together.
And of course that just brings up more questions, which which, before I go back to the influence of Ted Turner on filmmaking, I just wanted to go back to this Rage Over Trees, the film. And in your book, you also talk about some of the issues related to getting funding and how you balance influence from advertisers or donors with honest reporting. And I know that was an issue in the movie Rage Over Trees, and I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yeah. Well, the question of money and influence on content is very important. It's something that generally we're not sensitive enough to. These films can only be made with money. Where that money comes from has a big influence on the type of film you make. If you get money from a commercial, from a company, that company is going to want to see that its mission is furthered by the film. Now, the money can come in various forms. It can be in forms of sponsorship or direct investment, or can be a gift. But every time this happens, whatever form it takes, when it comes from a corporation, you try and keep the corporation out of the editorial content of the film, because it's just untenable, just like it would be for, the NRA to sponsor a film on gun control. No one would believe it. It would destroy the credibility of the film. So in this business, so in the environmental business, you know, if you have ExxonMobil sponsoring a film on conservation, no one's going to believe it. So you got to be very careful how you pick your sponsors or investors. Money can come from a bunch of different sources: corporations, foundations, wealthy individuals, and so on. the less strings you have attached, obviously, the better. You know, and anyone who says that sponsorship money doesn't influence the contents is not telling the truth. There is a link there, and I think you can see this. I mean, for example, there was a film, an IMAX film made about gold, and there was nothing wrong with the film. It was a fine film, and in it. It was full of the wonders of gold. What an extraordinary material it is. How glittering, how gorgeous, the necklaces, all the things you could do with it, the power of it. Nothing in the film about the vile and disgraceful environmental impact of gold mining, the way the pollution from it, all the terrible things that happen when you mine gold, the sickening aspect of gold mining on the environment. Now, there's nothing in the film about that. Well, why not? Well, surprise, surprise, the film was sponsored by gold mining companies. So, I mean, I think you always have to look at these films, see who's funding them, and check. There isn't an influence going on which destroys the validity of the film.
Under Ted Turner's leadership, was that a little less of an issue?
Yes, it was, only because he would stand up against the left. So we had two films, one called Rage Over Trees, I've already mentioned, which was about clear-cutting, and which the logging industry was so upset about that they boycotted our film and boycotted Tina Turner and forced all the advertisers off the program, as well as our sponsor, Stroh Brewery. So we lost huge amounts of money, but Ted broadcast the film anyway. And they later on, we got other funders to come back in. We did another film called about overgrazing, and this time the ranching industry came after us and boycotted TBS and Audubon, and again we lost money. But the thing about having someone like Ted in your corner, as I said before, he's fearless. And he doesn't mind losing money if it's the right thing to do. He thought the films were great. He thought they had a good message. They thought it was important for people to know that clear cutting was not a good thing. Overgrazing was not a good thing. And he wasn't going to be bullied and pushed around by the ranching industry or the logging industry. So he broadcast the films anyway. I tell the story in the book. So that was good. So having Ted in your corner makes a big difference.
And when his company was bought out by Time Warner, and then later in 2006 when he was essentially forced to step down as vice chairman of Time Warner, what was the impact of that shift?
We lost our programming. The impact was huge for us because he called me up one morning, very sad, and said, "Chris, I'm awfully sorry. My hand's been forced on this. I don't want. I mean, all my environmental programming on TBS Superstation is being taken away. Is being taken off. We're not doing it." So he said, "I'm awfully sorry. I wish we could find a way. I wish I didn't have to make this call to you, but I'm afraid I've just lost power here, and I can't do anything about it." So yes, it had a huge impact on us when he lost power there. It meant he couldn't put on the type of environmental programming that our programming at Audubon and National Wildlife Federation and others like Cousteau and National Geographic. He wasn't able to do it any longer. Other people took over the scheduling and the programming decisions from him.
That gets me into the issue of the actual programming and how it's changed over the years. In your book, Shooting in the Wild, you talk about what makes many nature documentaries so engaging is the sheer wonder of seeing those animals wild. But in your book, you're also revealing that many of those images are often staged.
Yes, the one reason I wrote my book, Shooting in the Wild, is because over 30 years of making these films, I've become increasingly haunted by things that really bothered me. Animal harassment during filming, deceptions of the audience, and the lack of conservation in the film. So these things really began to bother me. I wrote my book to draw attention to them. A lot of the animals we see in these films are not wild. They are controlled. They may be wild, but they're controlled and captive, and some of them are trained. So if you see a bear, close up of a bear, standing on his hind legs with his mouth open and roaring, it's probably almost certainly what's happening. Is behind the camera as the trainer giving it signals that is trained using M&Ms and jelly beans to train it, like, you know, by rewarding it with food to do certain things, open its mouth and roar to look menacing. And it's just an act, you know, just an act. So people get taken in by this, and it's not really fair. I think when people find out that the animals they're looking at are not really wild, but are captive and trained perhaps, and certainly in a controlled situation, they're not wild and free roaming, and yet the film has given the impression that they are, they feel cheated, and I think you know, this is a problem. The other thing, of course, on this, Laurel, is that these animals are often rented from game farms, which I talk about in my book, and these are very stressful places for animals, not good places for animals to be, especially big charismatic animals like bears and wolves and wolverines and lynx. These sorts of animals, they're kept in small cages, and then when people like me come along who want to make films, or still photographers who want to make pretty Christmas calendars with close-up of animals, they rent these animals, take them out, and so they look like they're free roaming and wild when they're not. So there's the animal welfare aspect of this, as well as the audience deception part of this.
Can you give me some examples of when you have used captive animals?
Yes, I can. In our Wolves IMAX film, this is before I really understood game farms and what they were, I rented wolves for that film because we wanted to get close up of wolves, and we couldn't get close up of wolves in the wild. We tried incredibly hard, but it's just impossible. You know, wolves are don't like to be around people and know that they're dangerous and will move away, and they move 50 miles a day. So trying to get an IMAX camera close to wild wolves is virtually impossible. You can occasionally get glimpses of them now in Yellowstone, but elsewhere, up in the Yukon, for example, is just, oh, it's impossible. So the only way to get close up of wolves and bears, for example, is to rent them out. And that's what I did when I made our Wolves IMAX film. Another example of fakery, Laurel, is in our Whales. I mentioned the Whales IMAX film before. We have a scene where you see the skull of a killer whale at the bottom of the sea to illustrate. We're talking then about the dangers of two migrating humpback whales of killer whales. This is one of the many obstacles they have to overcome as they take that 3,000-mile migration from their breeding grounds in Hawaii to their feeding grounds in Alaska. And we show a killer whale skull. Well, we put the skull there. You know, the audience thinks it was there just naturally in the bottom of the sea, on the sea bottom, but we actually put it there. So I'm afraid that routine manipulation and fabrication, manipulation and staging and fabrication is fairly routine in wildlife films. And that's why my book, Shooting in the Wild, has become controversial, I think, because people inside don't want their trade secrets to be given away. And yet, people on the outside are just delighted that someone is talking about this.
Why exactly do filmmakers take all these shortcuts?
Hi, Ben. You said, why do they take these shortcuts, right?
Yes.
Yeah. The reason they take these shortcuts is to save money. Where the budgets are very tight nowadays. I mean, the time really is over when people can go out for 4 or 5 months to get footage of extraordinary animal behavior. That occasionally does happen. For example, the BBC has very big budgets, and when they make films like Planet Earth or Life, they spend maybe $2 million an hour, and so they can send people out into the Himalayas to get pictures of snow leopards and so on. You know, they can spend the time, but for most wildlife filmmakers, you don't have 3 or 4 months. You actually have, you're lucky if you have 3 days. And to get footage, to get money shots in 3 days so that you get hired again and your executive producer of the network is pleased with your work, you had to find shortcuts. So that's why people do this, Ben. They're forced by the situation, the shortage of time, shortage of money, to do whatever it takes to get the shot. That often means fabricating it.
So do you think there are positive aspects to these deceptions?
There are. There are some positive aspects. That's a very good question, and that's why this subject is not a totally black and white. I mean, one positive aspect of these deceptions is that when you use wolves from a game farm, that means you are not disturbing, habituating wild wolves, or trying to disturb or habituate them, which is good. I mean, in other words, you're using the animals that are already habituated, and you're not messing around with wild animals. Because generally, the good rule is to stay away from animals, wild animals. They want to be left alone. You know, so use long lens, don't get in their face, don't get in their personal space. This is my problem with people like the late Steve Irwin and Jeff Corwin and Bear Grylls. All, you know, decent human beings, and they're all right, good family people. They're all good people. But my problem with them is that they insist, for the sake of ratings, they insist on getting in the personal space of animals, like reptiles and snakes. Remember how the late Steve Irwin used to jump on crocodiles and pick up snakes? And I just think we need to be more aware of animal welfare in this situation, and to harass animals, harass them and goad them for the sake of ratings and for the sake of money. I just don't see any justification for that. And sometimes we have to bother disturb animals, and because we're doing some scientific experiment. So, I mean, there are situations where it can be defensible, but too often we bother them just for the sake of entertainment. And I'd like to see much less of that. I just want to talk about Bear Grylls, because Bear Grylls is a...
I was just about to ask you about particularly unethical examples, especially...
Yes. Well, I think an unethical example is I can give you one here with Bear Grylls. There's a clip on YouTube now of him jumping into a river, a small stream really, about 10 foot wide, and grabbing a monitor lizard. It's about 3.5 feet, it's got very sharp claws. He holds it up by the tail, discusses it, shows his claws, and then he holds it by the tail and swings it as hard as he can against a tree to kill it, and then gets his knife out and plunges it into the back of the neck of the monitor lizard to kill it. And, of course, I think to be fair here, if there was an Animal Planet executive on the phone, by the way, they're all very good people. I know them. They're all terrific people. And if they're on the phone, they would say, well, wait a minute, Chris, that's not an environmental wildlife film. That's a survivalist film. But I think that's a distinction made by executives at networks, but I think it's not a distinction made by ordinary, regular people. As far as your average view is concerned, they're all about the natural world. And I just don't think killing an animal for the sake of ratings is a good thing. And I know Animal Planet and Discovery will say, well, wait a minute, Chris, wait. This is totally unfair of you. This film about Bear Grylls is about survival, and people's lives have been saved by things they've learned on his show. I would respond to that. Wait a minute, how many lives have been endangered by people trying to imitate him, do ridiculous stunts? So
I was going to ask you about this phenomena that the public will start imitating those hosts who recap.
Oh, it's a real problem. It's a real problem, and that's why. I mean, when Steve Irwin gets into the personal space of reptiles, jumps, picks up snakes, jumps on crocodiles, and so on. If there wasn't the problem of emulation, in other words, people looking at it and saying, oh, I want to do that, if that wasn't a problem, if people didn't do that, then there would be less of a concern, I suppose. But, that, you know, that's the problem, especially impressionable young people, people who have a heavy diet of these programs, of intrusive, watching intrusive on-camera hosts. They will watch, you know, the Jeff Corwins of the world, Steve Irwins of the world, and say, gosh, I'd like to do that. They go out to Yellowstone, they walk up to elk thinking it's safe to do so, and not realizing the harassment and disturbance they're causing the animals, let alone the danger they're putting their own lives into. That's why we see all the time in Yellowstone and Yosemite and places, people jumping out and walking up to bears thinking they're safe. And there's just so much ignorance about the natural world. These animals, you know, when you bother them, they become dangerous. They become scared and frightened, and they will lash out. And every year we get people killed by bears. Always the fault of people, never the fault of the bears. It's always because people get to, because they're dying to get that close-up shot, they get closer and closer, and, you know, it's just so bad, you know. And so I criticize these intrusive on-camera hosts like the late Steve Irwin because of the bad example they set. I also, by the way, praise them for their conservation work. They're good people, they mean well. It's just that in the pursuit of high ratings, they want to get close to animals, and that is not good.
So I wanted to go back to the idea of, you know, why some of these issues are so problematic and what the harm is. And we've talked a little bit about the animal abuse and the harassment. I wanted to get at what the problem with staging fake scenes.
A scene you can find in films is of a tree climbing snake goes up a tree, and then the next thing you see is the camera on the ground looking up and a snake falling down on you, and a naive viewer will think, well, that's just the snake has fallen out of a tree because it was chased out of a tree by an angry bird defending its nest or something, you know. But of course, what happened is that a fixer or an assistant or someone up the tree has dropped the snake out of the tree. Now, it's fakery, it's fraudulent, but it may be scientifically accurate. In other words, snakes do fall out of trees when they're harassed by animals defending their nests. You ask a very good question, Laura. What is the harm? Well, let's analyze this. On the one hand, let's just say it's scientifically accurate. In other words, snakes do occasionally get chased out of trees and will fall to the ground. Okay, so the behavior's accurate, so that's good. But what's wrong here, I think, is that the audience thinks they're watching something which happens completely naturally. They think that the cameraman was patient, waited for days, weeks, perhaps, under the tree for the tree to come, for the snake to come out, fall. And of course, we all know that doesn't happen. It was all staged and done in a couple of hours. So what's wrong? Well, I think what's wrong is that the audience is deceived. Now, does that matter? Well, maybe not. See, some people would say, hey, Chris, stop fussing, for God's sake. This is just filmmaking. This is just natural, ordinary, banal filmmaking artifice. I would ask the question, when does that artifice cross an ethical line into unacceptable audience deception? And I think it does happen too much. Although people, I agree that equally moral people will draw that line in different places. But I would, the point of my book, Shooting the Wild, is to push that line back a bit so that we are leaning more towards more transparency and less towards more deception.
Could that audience deception also backfire in terms of people thinking it's a lot easier to see wildlife close up?
Oh, that is such a good point. Honestly, people get so misled by television, because in television we cut out all the boring parts. People go out in the wild, they look around, wait a minute, where the heck are the animals? They just absolutely baffled to go out and they can't see anything because they're so used to television, just in constant action, predation, copulation, and, you know, they wonder why they can't go out and see it themselves. And it's because, 98% of the footage we shoot is thrown away because it's boring, and we just show you on television the exciting, dramatic, exciting chase scene or sex scene or whatever it is, you know. And so people get completely misled, and that's a problem, I think. Yeah.
And another aspect of the audience deception is the idea of the staging the animal fights. And I wanted to ask you about consistently depicting certain types of animals as murderous and evil. And Shark Week comes immediately to mind, and the demonization of sharks.
Right.
And what the impact of that is.
Well, I think it's not good. I mean, we've, you know, as you know, America and other countries go to UN meetings like CITES, to try and protect endangered species, animals like sharks and bluefin tuna and polar bears. And we have been amazed, though this is a complicated issue, but we've been amazed how difficult that is. You'd think it would be fairly simple to get the countries of the world to unite to protect sharks, with shark populations plummeting so severely. But we don't. We find it hard. We get outvoted, often outvoted. Why is that? Why isn't there more public support for this? Well, I think one reason is programs like Shark Week that demonize sharks. And so when our representatives go to CITES to try and persuade them to protect sharks, I think, you know, there's not enough public support there, because people generally think, well, when the sharks are dangerous, they're menacing, they're dark, they're dangerous, we should get rid of them. And so Shark Week, I think, it does have some good programs, and is run by very good people who mean well, but in their drive to get ratings, they show sharks as dangerous and man-eating monsters. And this is not good. Now, I'm not saying every program is like that on Shark Week, but for the most part, the reason it gets high ratings, people, the reason that key demographic males 21 to 36 tune in is because they want to see mayhem and murder and blood and attacks. And so it's in the interest, it's in the commercial interest of the network to promote Shark Week as showing exciting, dramatic, dangerous pictures, stories about sharks. So this is not good. We need to have more programs which show the true nature of sharks, which is sharks as they are. We now know we can swim outside shark cages with great whites without any trouble at all. We know sharks are far less dangerous than we used to think, and can often swim with even the dangerous, so-called dangerous sharks like bull sharks and great whites and tiger sharks that have been known to attack people, because most sharks do not attack. Most shark species do not attack. But there are three or four, like bull sharks, tiger sharks, that have a reputation for being dangerous. But we know even with those sharks, we can swim with them now outside shark cages. So these animals are not as dangerous as you've been led to believe by Shark Week. And I think Discovery has a responsibility, and they know this too, and they're just trying to balance their desire to promote conservation with their desire to get high ratings. But I think Discovery needs to lean its weight more towards conservation and portraying animals in an accurate, responsible, scientific way.
Where should filmmakers draw the line, and how do they develop the balance between getting the money shot and doing the work ethically?
Well, that's a very good question. No quick, easy answer to that, unfortunately, because need to do both. We do need to deliver exciting footage. We do need to behave ethically. And so I think generally this means not getting so close to animals, using long lenses to get close to them rather than physically get close to them. But I think the challenge, Ben, is that people like me and people like the new generation of wildlife filmmakers coming along, I think the challenge is to them now to come up with innovative, fresh, new ways to portray wildlife behavior, which is filmed in a responsible way, but which is also incredibly exciting and can compete against American Idol and other reality shows that we have to win, that we have to compete against. And I think it's up to the new generation of wildlife filmmakers coming out of places like like I run at American University, the Center for Environmental Filmmaking, or coming out of the Montana State University, has another good program on environment. So new filmmakers coming into the business now need to raise their sights. They need to really feel and be challenged and feel as challenged, then they need to come up with fresh, innovative ways to make these films. So they're incredibly exciting, incredibly entertaining, but at the same time do not involve animal harassment, do not involve omitting the word conservation, and do not involve deception of audiences, and you know, those are more transparent, so the audiences can trust what they're getting. By the way, I think Ben, that I should have said earlier in an answer to Laurel, that one of the problems with fakery is that when people find out about it and get disappointed, we run the risk that they will then mistrust everything else in the rest of the film, including any conservation messages. So that's one of the negatives of fakery and fraudulence.
Now, that's a really good point. And I wanted to talk about what can we do? You know, I know you've started a campaign among filmmakers, and can you tell us a little bit?
Yes,
about
that? I think there are certain things we can do. I mean, I think one thing we can do is before a company, for a network like Animal Planet or National Geographic commissions a film, they need to find out exactly how the film will be made. And when a filmmaker says, you know, in the treatment, we're going to have a close-up shot here of a lynx, I mean, instead of just letting that go and taking it for granted, the network needs to ask for full disclosure. They need to say to the filmmaker, well, wait a minute, how will you get that close-up of the shot? You know, and then if the filmmaker admits, well, I'm actually going to rent a lynx from a farm, from a game farm to do that, then the network has responsibility to check that that game farm is run very well, which is very unlikely, but it's a humanely run game farm, and then even if that shouldn't be done, they may at that point say, no, we're not accepting that, and you need to find that shot some other way. So I think full disclosure during pre-production, you know, before we start shooting, will help a lot. I think another thing is to work with reputable scientists, people who do good work and who are also scientists who are conscious of animal welfare and don't just just conscious of what they're doing. And so working with reputable, good scientists, humane scientists, I think is a good thing. I think another point is to make films about conservation that are entertaining. I mean, in other words, you know, we can't be dull, we can't be mundane, we can't be lecturing, we can't be hyperbolic. I mean, I think we have to find ways and challenge ourselves, produce films about conservation that use great legitimate drama, use humor, use inspiration, use other ways to make conservation totally intriguing and fascinating to people. And I think another thing, Laurel and Ben, is that every time we make a film, that has to be part of a campaign. You know, we've gone past the point where we could produce films just for the sake of producing a film. We now need to produce films for a purpose, a bigger purpose than the film itself, in order to promote conservation. And we need to have a social action part of that. We need to produce books to go with it, and op-ed pieces and lectures. In other words, it needs to be part of a lobbying. It needs to be part of a big campaign. We need films to be integrated into campaigns so they really can make a difference. So those are some of the things, Laurel, that I think we need to do in terms of solving these problems. And of course, improving ethical training of wildlife filmmakers is a very important thing. Teaching filmmakers that it's wrong to harm animals and wrong to deceive audiences and wrong to omit conservation.
And as someone who simply watches the films, what is their role in helping to promote better films?
Their role is to be more skeptical. Their role is to look at the film and then say, when they see a grizzly bear and a wolf sparring, fighting over a kill, to say, wait a minute, what is that? I wonder how they got that shot. And was that done with animals? And to write a letter to the network saying, how did you get that shot? How did you get that Did you use a controlled bear and will to get that shot? And where do they come from? And were they treated carefully? And what's going to happen to those animals once they pass their life as an on-camera animal? Are they going to be killed? What's going to happen? And will they be looked after? And, you know, to ask these types of questions and not just accept what you see on television, but to write to networks and that demand clarity and disclosure of how these films are made.
And you talk a lot about sort of using new media more effectively, both to extend the conservation impact of films. And also I'm wondering about how viewers can use social media to make sure that ethical, you know, more ethical films rise above the crowd.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very good question, and I'm not sure I can give a very good answer except to say the obvious. I mean, we need to use social media. We need to get on the websites of the Animal Planet, Geographic, and ask them questions. We need to talk to our friends. We need to on Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter. We need to promote the films that are made responsibly. When people watch a great film that they know is made responsibly and has a great conservation message, they need to talk about it and to encourage their friends through Facebook to watch it. They need to ask when they see a film they worry about, wait a minute, that animal looked like it was really harassed. That looked like it was really harassed during that shot. How is that done? They need to talk to people, raise questions on Facebook and other social network sites and how it was done. So I think people can use these sites to build a community around this issue of how to produce films that are pro-conservation and done with animal welfare in mind.
And I just wanted to close by any good examples that you could cite of films that are made responsibly, just to hold up as examples of what people should look for.
Yes, I think Lowell and Ben, Planet Earth, was a very good series because it did have a conservation message, a light conservation message, but a good one. And I think I would hold up Planet Earth. I couldn't detect any manipulation or fraudulence in there at all. I think it was a very good show. I think Whale Wars on Animal Planet, the series about Paul Watson, I think has a lot of merit to it, and really brings home the issue of whaling. I think An Inconvenient Truth was good, surprising success with Al Gore. I think it had a good, important message, and so that was, I think another good one would be Battle at Kruger. This is just a YouTube success, Battle at Kruger, K-R-U-G-E-R. Your listeners can look it up on YouTube. It's a wonderful 8-minute film about an completely natural interaction between a herd of buffalo, a pride of lions, and some crocodiles, and just incredibly dramatic shots, not shot by a wildlife filmmaker, but shot by a tourist. Battle of Kruger, very worth watching. I think the number of hits now is up to something like 40 million people have watched it. And I think finally I would point out, I think The Cove, that won an Academy Award this year, a wonderful film about the slaughter of whales in Japan, in Taipei. That slaughter is still going on, and we need to put an end to it. But I think it's a very, very good film and illustrates what I mean by finding new, fresh, innovative ways of telling these stories. So I think those are some films, Lowell, that I would pick as being worth watching. And I think I mentioned earlier on Great Migrations, the new National Geographic series, I think is also worth watching.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time out to talk with us today.
Oh, I'm so happy, Lowell and Ben. Delighted and honored to be on your show. I feel privileged to talk with you both.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about wildlife filmmaking with Chris Palmer, veteran wildlife filmmaker, director of environmental filmmaking at American University's School of Communication, and author of the new book, Shooting in the Wild, An Insider's Account of Making Movies in the Animal Kingdom, published by Sierra Club Books. Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelnemi.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's mongabay.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnimi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nimi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.